From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. World attention is focused on Baghdad tonight. But farther south, at a string of beachfront villas in Kuwait City, a team of American administrators in waiting are hammering out a blueprint for a transitional government that they expect to lead in post-war Iraq. It's a huge project with many unresolved questions, but the Pentagon-led team may only be days away from stepping into governing authority in Baghdad. Tonight on Point, the day after victory, and who will run Iraq? We begin with the latest on plans for and debate over Iraq's post-war government. Elizabeth Becker, Washington correspondent for the New York Times, has been following the story. I asked her to describe the state of plans for how Iraq will be ruled the day after the war.
That's still in doubt. There's the Pentagon or the administration's plans, which would be to have a civilian team made up almost entirely of Americans, run by Jay Garner, who has an office in the Pentagon. This is a big break with tradition because in the last decade or so, most of the post-war operations have been run by the UN, which leads to the other option. Right now, Secretary of State Colin Powell is in Europe talking to European leaders who, almost to a person, including Tony Blair of the United Kingdom, would like the UN to have a big role. The administration has been pretty fuzzy about whether or not they're going to change their ideas, and then there's the situation on the ground. Over in Kuwait, there's a team of now almost 200 people under Mr. Garner. They're former diplomats, current diplomats, who are preparing to go in and run the civilian arm of the occupation.
Until the pushback came from Europe and perhaps from the State Department, what was the plan? Until quite recently, it was fairly straightforward, wasn't it? Jay Garner, former general, and under him, an array of U.S. officials that would run Iraq.
It's a scheme that looks very much like a very slimmed-down peacekeeping operation. The country would be divided into three regions, north, central, and south, each having an administrator. Then under, according to jobs, there'd be someone in charge of humanitarian, someone in charge of reconstruction, et cetera, et cetera. That, as far as I know, is still in place. There will be diplomats as well who will be something like shadow ministers, making sure that the ministries of the Iraqi government will be watched over. And that's because this is seen as a transition authority rather than a permanent one. The contracts these people signed were anywhere from 3 to 6 months, and they were hoping that they could be out that soon, but I don't know if that's going to happen.
So you've heard the reports and no doubt followed much more closely even than we have. These teams meeting every morning along the Persian Gulf there in Kuwait City, making their plans. What's happening to the original plans as we see how the war actually unfolds and as we hear opposition from Europe and others to a U.S.-led transition government?
Well, what the team in Kuwait is doing essentially is refining the plans. They were pulled together so hastily that, you know, they're now studying the history of Iraq, and many of them don't speak Arabic fluently, and they're brushing up on that, and they're refining. But what's happened overall in a diplomatic sense is that there still isn't approval from the allies on where to go. And I think Great Britain is going to play a key role in whether or not this is going to go ahead as planned. As I said, Secretary Powell is in Europe trying to come up with an agreement at least on coordinating humanitarian relief. But the overall position in the United States is no matter what role the UN plays, it would be subordinate to the United States. And that's where the real issue is. The UN wants to be a partner, but not a subordinate.
Secretary Powell said only today, reaffirmed that U.S. position, that whatever happened would be U.S.-led and not U.N.-led. How big a break is that, Elizabeth Becker, from reconstruction efforts we've seen in the last several decades?
Except for Bosnia, almost all of them have been U.N. And this sort of dates from the end of the Cold War. The first big reconstruction and peacekeeping was in Cambodia after the Cold War. Mm-hmm. The last one is Afghanistan, which is U.N.-led after the American and coalition war. Bosnia was an exception, but even there it was a coalition. It was not just one country. It was all the countries who signed the Dayton Peace Accords. So I personally can't think of a peacekeeping slash reconstruction effort that wasn't run by the United Nations or an international coalition. The fact that it would be an American operation, it would be directly under American military, harkens back to another era of military occupations.
Sort of post-World War II, Japan and Germany, this would be Jay Garner reporting to General Tommy Franks.
Exactly, and there's no example of that people have been able to dredge up. It is very, very different. And part of it is a response of people who don't like the UN, who think it's too cumbersome, who think that pulling all these countries in is too bureaucratic, and they prefer the idea that they think will work to go in quick and get out quick and hand it over to an interim authority.
It seems incredible at some level that at this late hour, or what's beginning to look more and more like a late hour, there's still a debate over the fundamental structure of what this transitional authority will look like. What's the debate inside Washington between the State Department and Pentagon? What are the dimensions of that debate?
It's an old one. It's been carried out through much of this administration, and it's just getting larger because of this war situation. The war is being fought by the Defense Department, and the Defense Department wants to hold on to authority in the post-war period. Now, traditionally, aid reconstruction is under the State Department. That's where the USAID is, the Agency for International Development. Now, the contracts for reconstructions are being let by USAID, but reconstruction and humanitarian goes under the offices of Jay Garner. So you can see that the State Department feels that its traditional roles and responsibility are taken away by the military. And this follows on an even longer dispute where, since the days of President Clinton, far more money has been going to the Defense Department, and the Defense Department is having a greater authority in foreign affairs, leading to the old joke around here that we've got two secretaries of state, Colin Powell and Donald Rumsfeld. So it's a long simmering, and it's so far it looks like the Pentagon is winning.
Clearly, the instinct of this administration was to lead with the Pentagon. Why that bias toward the Pentagon in rebuilding here?
Efficiency, the sense that they've already invested in the military can do the big chores. And the military would mean the United States retains control, whereas if you do the State Department alternative, it would go to the control would be international. Because there's no question that there has been the sense that the State Department would be more amenable, I'm not saying how much, but more amenable to the idea of sharing the authority as well as the burden with other countries.
And is it your sense, Elizabeth Becker, that even at this point, this might all be turned around and we might see significantly larger UN role than it's been envisioned so far, or not?
I almost never predict, but I do know that the question hasn't been answered yet, and I don't see a lot of movement yet. The one fly in the ointment in terms of the United States is that with all of this authority is a huge cost. And I think the thing that will make the United States possibly revisit that issue is that, you know, who can afford this? We didn't pay for the last Gulf War. We had a lot of countries contributing. This time around, the United States is not only paying for the military side, but if this plan goes through and other countries don't contribute what they would like, we'd also be paying for the reconstruction. That's a huge bill. And given the current economic state, I think people will think twice.
Elizabeth Becker is Washington correspondent for The New York Times. She spoke with me from Washington. Secretary of State Colin Powell was in Brussels today, meeting his NATO and European Union counterparts. When it comes to UN involvement in post-war Iraq, this is what he had to say.
There will definitely be a UN role, but what the exact nature of that role will be remains to be seen.
Bottom line, Powell said, the U.S., not the UN, will run the show. And the plan has been everything from the civil administration of Iraq to post-war reconstruction to humanitarian assistance, the work of 23 Iraqi ministries, all to be headed by Americans, all overseen by General Tommy Franks and retired Army Lieutenant General Jay Garner. But as the distance between U.S. troops and central Baghdad shrinks, questions on exactly who will run Iraq, how they will do it, and for how long continue to boil. A Pentagon team is on standby in Kuwait, waiting to launch the Defense Department's plan to administer post-war Iraq. Europeans and Tony Blair express shock that the U.S. would almost sideline the U.N., and Washington has its own post-war feud simmering between the State Department and the Pentagon. Are you ready for an American viceroy in Baghdad? Do you agree with Colin Powell that the U.S. should have significant dominating control in post-war Iraq? Or should Washington be happy to hand the reins over to the United Nations? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Bathsheba Crocker, fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and author of Postwar Iraq, Are We Ready?, a very substantial report published just last week by the CSIS. Good evening and welcome, Bathsheba Crocker.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. You've put a lot of time into studying what's going to be required and what's planned and underway for this interim authority, this transitional authority in Iraq post-war. No one knows exactly when the post-war begins, Bathsheba Crocker, but as we look out on what's going on tonight, what's your level of confidence in the planning for what will follow the military, or at least the major portion of the military conflict here?
My level of confidence is probably mixed, I would say. The administration has done a great deal of planning in certain areas and is farther along in those areas than I think we might have expected them to be, given where we usually are at this stage in the game. But there are some major outstanding questions, particularly surrounding the post-war civil administration or governance of Iraq, as you were just discussing.
The U.S. probably hasn't taken on a project of this size, kind of taking a large country and refashioning its entire economy and political system since World War II, Japan and Germany, as Elizabeth Becker was saying. Of course, that includes a political refashioning and control of all these agencies. How is that supposed to work? We hear about Americans in Kuwait City trying to learn Arabic who haven't been in Iraq in a decade or more, or maybe never. They're just going to parachute in and suddenly be in charge? How?
Well, it's a very good question. That seems to be the idea. It's been described to me as the office in a box model, and the box will open up and out will pour this office of about 200 people to fan throughout the country and start running everything from the towns and the cities to all of the major government ministries in Baghdad. It is a very ambitious plan, and what is somewhat worrisome to me at this point is the idea, which General Garner and other administration officials are talking about, that they might only be in there for 90 days, after which time they would have supposedly stabilized the entire country, put in the beginnings of democratic institutions and democracy in the country, and then pull out and turn things over to the Iraqis.
How does this look when you compare it to what happened in Japan and Germany after World War II, Bathsheba Crocker? Those are cited by the Bush administration. Are we in comparable circumstances? I mean, the country has set out to have this war. It has set out to kick out a regime. That means you have to have a new regime come in. Once you've set on that course, you've got to do something when the war is over.
Well, I think the difference here is that, for one, for the Germany model, for example, the planning went into that at least 2 years in advance. So the planning was much more advanced than what we see here. I don't think you would have seen sort of people sitting on the sidelines waiting to go in studying up on German, the German language, for example. They were much more prepared. I think they went in with many more people. This is an office of 200 people going in to supposedly administer a country of 23, 24 million people. So in that sense, it's very different. And I think also there was a much longer term commitment. We were in Germany for 4 years to carry out the Marshall Plan. I don't think that it's realistic to think the Garner office will be in Iraq for only 3 months. But it's still worrisome that the level of commitment doesn't seem to be there. I agree with that part of the administration's plan, which calls for as much Iraqi involvement and ownership of this process as possible and as quickly as possible. But my concern is too much pressure to turn it over to Iraqis before the situation is really ready for them to absorb the responsibilities and authorities that come along with that. And I think it's just unrealistic to think that it will happen as quickly as the administration is predicting.
And has the war, as it's proceeded so far, made you more or less concerned about that transition?
I think more concerned because we are seeing more resistance than they expected to think. And one of the things that the Garner office appears to be rethinking as they're on the ground in Kuwait waiting to go in is they appear to be rethinking how they're going to handle things based on the fact that we, the U.S. and coalition forces, are not being welcomed with open arms as they were originally predicting. And it's concerning because, of course, if there is ongoing resistance, even at low levels, just pockets of resistance throughout the country, that will obviously make things more difficult from a transitional government point of view.
Bathsheba Crocker, stand by. We want to get into the details of what's being planned here. It's a pretty amazing ambition, but it is the American official ambition right now. We're talking about the day after victory and who will govern Iraq. The answer right now is a lot of Americans, many of whom don't speak Arabic. Are you ready for an American viceroy in Baghdad? Is this the best way to launch a new Iraq? Is there any real alternative? And should the U.S. or the U.N. be taking the reins in Iraq? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the day after victory and who will govern Iraq. My guest tonight is Bathsheba Crocker. She's a resident at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and lead author of a very hefty new study, Post-War Iraq, Are We Ready? It's an open question, perhaps even tonight. Today in Brussels at NATO headquarters, Colin Powell spoke about how responsibility and authority would be distributed and why in Iraq after the war.
It was the coalition that came together and took on this difficult mission at political expense, at the expense of the treasure, the money that it costs, but at the expense of lives as well. And when we have succeeded, and when we look down the road to create this better life for the Iraqi people, to rebuild this society, to rebuild this country after these decades of devastation wrought by Saddam Hussein, I think the coalition has to play the leading role in determining the way forward.
Colin Powell today in Brussels. You can join our conversation tonight. Are you ready for an American viceroy in Baghdad? Do you agree with Colin Powell that the U.S. should have significant dominating control in post-war Iraq? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Bathsheba Crocker, could you just paint the kind of mural of challenges that are going to be awaiting this U.S.-led administration on the day that it arrives in Baghdad and elsewhere around Iraq?
Well, one of the first challenges is going to be to ensure that Iraq's civil servants continue to be employed. The administration's plan, as we understand it, does include paying the salaries of 2 million Iraqi civil servants, which will be key because, of course, you can't have these people all of a sudden unemployed and adding to the big economic woes and humanitarian crisis that we're otherwise going to see.
And those are existing civil servants, so they're part of Saddam Hussein's regime.
Exactly. It is assumed that the top level of that regime and his closest loyalist will be de-bathified, as it were, that all of the government ministries and institutions will be vetted for those who were immediate Saddam loyalists, but that underneath those, there is an enormous existing and very capable Iraqi civil servant class that can and should be made use of to continue the provision of basic government services.
And let's just take that for a second, if we may, Bathsheba Crocker. In your view, A, is there any alternative to that? And B, these are part of the regime that's been so reviled, and we've read an awful lot about how far down the chain of command some pretty ugly stuff goes. Can this group of 2 million bureaucrats who will come onto the U.S. payroll, can they win the respect and compliance of the Iraqi population? Will they be the right partners, or is it just they're the only partners we've got?
Well, I think there is a certain degree to which they're the only partners we've got. And I think in the very immediate term, you do need to rely on the existing civil servants and technocratic class to keep things running, because it is just simply not going to be okay if the electricity doesn't get turned on, if the water doesn't flow, if the trash doesn't get picked up. Mm-hmm. We're also going to need help in distributing humanitarian assistance, which will be an immediate need. It is, of course, an open question whether there may be a lot of resistance to Ba'ath Party officials continuing on in their jobs. And I think it is expected that the very high-level officials, there will be some revenge sought against those officials and that they will need to be cleared out of their jobs. But many, many, many people in Iraq are members of the Ba'ath Party, sort of card-carrying members of the Ba'ath Party, only because if they weren't, there could be significant repercussions for their family members. If you are, mm-hmm. it is very helpful in terms of getting your children into school and other things like this, as far as we understand it. And it seems to what people think is that on the lower level, it may not be as controversial to let those people continue on in their jobs. And as I said, in the immediate term, I think it may be our only option, because going into the country with only 200 people in the civil administration role, we will not have enough people. And we don't know the country. We don't necessarily speak Arabic, and we won't know how to get these things started and make sure they maintain up and running.
Is there a risk that this just won't work? I mean, when a U.S. administrator shows up at one of these ministries, the Ministry of Industry or you name it, who is he or she going to turn to say, how do we do X, Y, and Z? We read that the Americans are trying to identify the so-called good Iraqis that they can work with. Are they there for these parachute administrators to work with?
We have to assume that they are there. I mean, this is a very large country with that's very educated, urban, sophisticated population for the most part. I think there will be people to work with. As you mentioned, the administration has been doing some work ahead of time. The U.S. government has been doing some work to try to identify potential partners, and they have supposedly put together a list of 2,000 Iraqis, some of whom are people we know are bad and need to be gotten rid of, but the vast majority of whom they seem to think we are actually people who we will be able to work with and will be useful in the post-war government phase.
And what's your sense of this debate about the U.S. versus the U.N. Running this operation? Is it correct in your mind or most effective that the U.S. do it? It breaks an awful lot of precedent. Is that a problem? Is it again, the only way, given how central the U.S. military has been to the war?
I think it's the only way for the very, very immediate term until the situation is stabilized. And I think most people, even those who want to see a greater UN role, would agree that in the very short term, Tommy Franks needs to be in control because we need to get the situation safe and secure and stable and as a security matter. But after that, I do not agree that the U.S. should be in the lead role. And I actually agree with those who are pushing for a UN role at that point. I think
how quickly, Bathsheba? I'm sorry.
Well, as soon as the situation is stable enough, and that I just don't think we know. I mean, I've seen estimates of anywhere from a few months to up to 2 years, and I think a lot of that will depend on one thing we were discussing earlier, which is the degree of ongoing resistance there may be after the war. If we see a lot, if we see pockets of ongoing resistance, if we see a lot of ethnic violence, if we see a lot of score-settling violence, if there is a major problem in the north between the Kurds and the Turks, or the Kurds are pushing for independence, any of these sort of factors that we haven't seen play out yet, it could mean that there is a longer period of time when the U.S. or the coalition military has to maintain the stability and security in the country. But assuming it's a matter of a few months to stabilize the country, then I would argue that at that point, we need to start talking about the U.N. coming in to play the sort of advisory civil administration role rather than the U.S.
Bathsheba Crocker, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Niall Gardner. He's joining us from Washington. He's a visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation. He's author of the recent brief entitled Limit the Role of the United Nations in Post-War Iraq. Good evening and welcome, Niall Gardner.
Good evening.
You know what a heavy debate is underway between the U.S. and Europe and to some extent in Washington itself about whether the United States or the U.N. should be leading this operation. Why do you think it's so important for the U.S. to do it and not the U.N.? The U.N. has done it in many countries over the last decade and more.
Well, I think the United Nations is simply not up to the task here. I believe that the U.S. and Great Britain can do a far better job of administering Iraq and also running the security operation, which will probably involve about 60,000 troops. But I believe also that the United Nations lacks the moral authority to run post-war Iraq, as the UN failed to enforce no less than 17 resolutions calling for Iraqi disarmament. And therefore, I believe that both on a moral ground and for practical reasons, the United Nations should be limited to a purely humanitarian role in a post-war Iraq.
So is it fundamentally an ideological critique you're making here, Niall Gardner, that you just don't want the UN to be involved? You want to be done with all that?
I think it's not just ideological. I think it's also based on practical reasons. Also, I think it's important, of course, to keep out the main countries who have opposed the very idea of regime change, who have appeased Saddam Hussein for decades, namely one thinks of France, Russia, and Germany. And clearly the French and the Russians are maneuvering themselves for a key role in a post-war administration through the United Nations, using the UN as a Trojan horse.
Bathsheba Crocker, what about this issue of moral authority? I'm not sure where that lies here, though Niall Gardner is. In his view, it's with the U.S. and the U.K. But in a reconstruction phase, is that so clear to you? And can France and Germany and other major countries be just sealed out of this perpetually until it's handed over to the Iraqis?
Well, my concern with the U.S. maintaining control in the post-war phase for too long is actually a concern about the moral authority and legitimacy of the United States in the eyes of the rest of the world. That is one of my biggest concerns with the U.S. continuing in its occupation role for too long. So although I agree at a certain level that the U.N. did largely sort of fall down on the job in terms of implementing its 17 resolutions that it passed with respect to Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, I don't think the necessary follow-on from that is that the UN or other UN member states, UN Security Council members, should not play a role in the post-war phase. I actually think the post-war reconstruction reconstruction effort will have a much greater degree of legitimacy if we see it as being a more internationalized effort and not a solely U.S. and U.K.-led effort.
Nell Gardner, are you concerned that we could see kind of an international isolation of Iraq if not everyone takes your view that the U.S. has the greater moral authority here, in fact that the U.S. may be seen as a kind of, you know, occupier and not at all in a positive sense, that might actually lead to problems for Iraq coming out of this difficult patch?
I don't think it's an issue of international legitimacy here. I think that the U.S. and the U.K. have every right to run a post-war Iraq, having removed a brutal dictatorship from power.
But what right? By international law? By just the use of power? The projection of power? Power makes the
well,
right?
Well, I think that London and Washington have clearly done the right thing here, which is to remove a brutal dictator who has terrorized his own population for decades and who has also developed weapons of mass destruction. So I think that there is every moral right on the side of the U.S. and the U.K. in this issue. On the other hand, I think the French and the Russians and the Germans have promoted foreign policies based upon utter moral bankruptcy by appeasing Saddam Hussein.
And are you at all concerned that this could turn into a real tar baby for the U.S. and the U.K.? Very expensive, unending, thankless, ultimately.
I think the key issue here is to ensure that Iraq no longer acts as a major state-sponsored terrorism, does not produce weapons of mass destruction, and hopefully we'll also see a democratic state emerge in Iraq as well. But I think that ultimately we will see a success story in Iraq, a new Iraq run for the Iraqi people. And I don't think it really matters so much what, for example, the European Union thinks on this matter. I think they're a total irrelevance, actually, on the Iraq question.
Nell Gardner, we've got your view, and thank you for sharing it with us tonight.
Thanks
for joining us. Nell Gardner is visiting fellow at the Heritage Foundation. Bathsheba Crocker, what are the politics behind this? You can hear it just running very hot through Nell Gardner's commentary there. Is this all about the shape, not just of the future of Iraq, but the future of the world, of global organization, a way of giving the back of the hand to the UN and saying that's just not going to be where these things get done anymore?
Well, certainly if we push this to an extreme, you could see that. But I don't see that happening in the immediate term. And I think the statements that we're seeing from the administration that the UN does have a role to play here, although they haven't defined what that role is a sign, is a sort of acknowledgement of the fact that we are going to walk some way back from the standoff that we found ourselves in before going to the war itself and try to come to some terms, some mutually agreeable terms with the other members of the Security Council. But clearly, there are a lot of political sensitivities here. And one of the reasons that we haven't seen a good articulation by the administration yet of what it wants the UN's role to be is precisely because we are seeing an ongoing battle within Washington between the State Department and the Defense Department over what that battle should be, which sort of precludes us from getting to the next level of discussions with our friends and allies and with the UN as to what an appropriate role is.
And at this point, many of the plans that are in place or being developed are entirely or largely unannounced, secret for Baghdad. I want to welcome to our conversation Colonel Dennis Murphy. He's joining us from Carlisle, Pennsylvania. He's Director of Operations at the Center for Strategic Leadership, Army War College, and author of The Day After the Army in Post-War Iraq. Good evening, Colonel Murphy.
Good evening, Tom.
Thanks for joining us. Clearly, the U.S. military, well, Tommy Franks is going to be in charge of everything with Jay Garner beneath him on the organizational chart here. But everything that happens in Iraq is going to be interwoven with the U.S. military. There's been a lot of debate about how many U.S. troops will be required for how long to provide the kind of base of security in which this development is supposed to take place post-war. What do you see as the likely necessary contingent of U.S. forces?
Well, it's as Beth mentioned, it's difficult to judge that because it's based on a number of factors, whether the factions within Iraq remain stable and don't rise up, what the reaction is by the Iraqi people, and so on. The bottom line is that ground forces that remain and coalition ground forces in Iraq will be required to set the conditions for the desired end state, and that's a new regime, a disarmed WMD program, and a stable pro-West Iraq. And they'll conduct a variety of tasks to do that until that end state is met. And there'll be a gradual withdrawal of those forces and a handover to civilian authorities as that end state is achieved.
But I've read something like 65,000, 80,000 personnel required. Is that in your report? Is that military personnel?
Yeah, that is a study that's been done and some other studies that have been done. The numbers are wide-ranging. And, of course, a lot of that does depend on the coalition contribution to this. If we're talking 65 to 80,000 personnel, how many of those are U.S. forces versus coalition forces? So the post-conflict coalition is an important factor because it will determine the number of U.S. forces that have to remain to sustain that.
You also expect a U.S.-led, U.N.-supported occupation to last 5 or even 10 years, as I read it. Has that scenario changed at all since the U.S. bucked the U.N. and has not made a clear place at the table for them yet? Are we talking about the U.S. in an occupation force in Iraq for 5 or 10 years?
Well, I think the right term is presence, actually, versus occupation. But and again, it's hard to say how long that will take. We've been in Bosnia now for about, as I recall, it's 5 to 8 years now.
A much smaller country.
A smaller country, but also you see an improvement in that country and a gradual withdrawal of U.S. forces to a much more manageable level. To make a relative comparison based on size and the situation there from a strategic perspective isn't really prudent. So, studies have indicated it could be a long-term effort, but the intent is to establish this stable environment and transition to civil authorities as quickly as possible. And there are many factors that will contribute to how quickly or slowly that will occur.
But there's a snapshot of what may be required on the military side of this equation. Dennis Murphy, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Certainly.
Colonel Dennis Murphy is Director of Operations at the Center for Strategic Leadership at the Army War College. Bathsheba Crocker, here is this intertwined military and military-overseen civilian component. Can you see the J. Garner operation getting out of Iraq a lot earlier than the U.S. military?
Well, that certainly seems to be the plan. I think the idea is that the U.S. military or some coalition military force will likely have to remain in Iraq for a good period of years, but that the J. Garner operation won't remain there that long. As I was mentioning earlier, their current plans are for the Garner office to be in there for 3 months, which, again, I think is overly optimistic.
A lot of doubt being
cast
on that already.
But I do think that the peacekeeping forces will be on the ground for a longer period of time supporting an Iraqi interim authority, which is sort of like the situation we see now in Afghanistan.
I want to come back and look with you, Bathsheba Crocker, at the Iraqi side of this and how soon and to whom this interim authority might be turned over to a new Iraqi government. We're looking tonight at the day after victory and who will govern Iraq. The answer right now is a lot of Americans, many of whom do not speak Arabic. What do you think? Does the U.S. deserve governing authority because it fought and won most of this war? Or is American control a recipe for quagmire even after the fighting? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined by Bathsheba Crocker, author of Postwar Iraq, Are We Ready? You can join us as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the day after victory and who will govern Iraq. The plan right now is for it to be Americans. 200 Americans are sitting in Kuwait City with their files and their flowcharts, planning to run a country of 24 million Iraqis on the other side of war, with the Pentagon at the top of that chain of command. Last week, Colin Powell sat before the Subcommittee on Commerce, Justice, State, and Judiciary in the House Appropriations Committee and said this about the future of Iraq and the U.S. role there.
We didn't take on this huge burden with our coalition partners not to be able to have significant, dominating control over how it unfolds in the future. And we would want to go from a military-oriented center of gravity rapidly to a civilian-oriented center of gravity, and then the center of gravity shifting to Iraqis who are governing themselves and starting to demonstrate their capacity to govern. And we'll be there for as long as it is necessary until they are stable.
significant dominating control is the byword and appears to be even today when Colin Powell was confronted in Brussels by an awful lot of European clamor for a significant UN role. My guest tonight is Bathsheba Crocker, resident at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. You're welcome to join the conversation as well at 1-800-423-8255. Charles is calling. Hi, Charles. You're on the air.
Hi. Are we not now suffering from a sort of national moral uncertainty, an uncertainty that we didn't suffer from half a century ago at the conclusion of World War II, when we said our system is right, our system, which is based on individualism, freedom, individual rights, a constitution that strictly limits the power of government, that strictly limits the power of unlimited majority rule, that strictly keeps religion out of government so that government is by reason rather than mystical revelation. Are we not now able to look back at the magnificent success of post-World War II Germany and Japan, to whom we bequeathed our a system similar to our magnificent system? And why would we look to the UN, who have conspicuously failed in their post-war efforts in any way that could compare to the successes of post-war Japan?
So, Charles, you're saying don't hesitate, take those American values and political structure and go for it in Iraq.
Absolutely, yes.
Well, Bathsheba Crocker, let me put a practical question to you first on that score, and that is exactly what is expected of this transitional authority in terms of bringing a new political system to Iraq. What are they concretely supposed to do? Will they sit down with Iraqis and write a new constitution? And do you feel in the Bush administration, to Charles' question, the kind of a political, moral fervor to go out and do that?
Well, as to the question of what will they do, there are plans, as far as I understand it, to set up a series of commissions or councils to deal with issues like writing a new constitution and writing new legal codes for Iraq. So there are that is part of the plan of what they'll be doing. In the interim, they will also just be running the towns and the cities. They will be municipal authorities throughout Iraq. As for the question of the spreading of democracy, I'm not sure that there is much uncertainty on that score. I think that's certainly what the Bush administration wants to do here. And I think that there is probably a complete national agreement throughout the U.S. population that that is what we should do, and we should be spreading democracy throughout the world. The question is, how much do we impose from the outside, and how much do we do this through a process of putting in place institutions and beginning to put in place values and doing political development work and civil society development work so that the Iraqis can build this themselves from the ground up.
But is this a culture that's likely to be receptive to those American political systems and values in the way that Japan and Germany were post-World War II?
Well, they don't have a history of it in the way that at least Germany did. So in that sense, I think it will take a much longer time. But I certainly do not purport to be in a position to say whether Iraqis will be able to democratize or will be receptive to those ideals. One has to assume that they will, and that this is a country that will be, for the most part, the population will be exceedingly happy to get rid of Saddam Hussein, if we do get rid of Saddam Hussein, and will be clamoring for the kinds of individual rights and freedoms that the democracy could bring. But I think that it will be a very long-term process, which is why talk of a very short U.S. rule and then turnover to the Iraqi interim authority worries me, because you hear General Garner saying things like, we are going to create democratic institutions in Iraq in 90 days, and I just don't think that's feasible.
So if short rule won't do it, but a long rule, to use your word, looks financially and maybe politically unpalatable, I mean, and perhaps to the Iraqis as well, is there a little bit of delusion somewhere in the middle here?
Well, I'm not sure I want to say it's delusion, but I think that there is a little bit of unrealistic expectations going on here. And I do think the notion of building democratic institutions within 3 months is a bit delusional. I think what we are more likely to see is a turnover to an Iraqi interim authority, probably not in 3 months, but maybe in 6 months, maybe in a year. And at that point, the question becomes, is it the U.S. that continues to play a role advising and assisting that Iraqi interim authority? Or at that point, is it reasonable for the U.N. to come in and play that role.
Mark is calling from Oxford, Massachusetts. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you. I must say very quickly that you have an incredible program. I really, you put cable TV to shame.
Thank you, Mark. What's on your mind tonight?
Very quickly, Yogi Berra said, never predict, especially when it involves the future. But I will go ahead anyway. We are not talking about post-war occupation of Japan, which where the emperor pretty much allowed us to occupy it. And
sanctioned the occupation for the Japanese people.
And Germany's case, pretty much the German people had devastated after a four-year war.
What are you expecting here, Mark?
Well, in Bosnia, we were a peacekeeping force. What I am saying here is that after the victory where the war continues, so we are talking about occupying a country where both ethnic differences and the anger against the occupation force in the middle of the Middle East, covered with all the other nations that are so hated, hating us, would be really a delusion, especially if we occupy it rather than take the UN in. But it will be a hot potato. You wouldn't want to come in into a place and try to clean up a mess that we created and while they are getting killed.
But something has to happen here, Mark. But thank you for your call. Let me put it to Bathsheba Crocker. The first thing raised here is the possibility of a setting in Iraq that's really not pacified, that could have all kinds of resistance. Who knows? But for a long time, how do you mount all this reconstruction and reform if it's, let's say, even as unruly as Afghanistan, our last time out?
Well, it certainly becomes much more difficult. And one of the things that will be needed is a fairly large security force that spans throughout the country to try to manage that potential, particularly if it looks down the line like that potential is a very real one. In Afghanistan, of course, there was a decision not to expand the stability force outside of Kabul, and that has caused lasting problems even in distribution of humanitarian assistance. So in terms of that problem, I mean, what you'll see is a need for a much larger security and stabilization force on the ground.
At bottom, given what we've seen in Afghanistan and given the kind of unrealistic timetable you're giving us a heads up on here tonight, is there a kind of naivete? We read these reports of gaggles of people gathered around pools in Kuwait City, sort of juggling filofaxes and trying to learn Arabic. Is this the real thing? Is it on a scale and seriousness comparable to that we saw in Japan and Germany, or is it kind of, you know, flying by the seat of our pants?
It's a little bit flying by the seat of our pants. At least there's a few months of planning that have gone into it. And the State Department has been doing a lot of thinking about the post-war phase in terms of things like a future constitution and a future government structure for many, many months now.
But isn't the Pentagon vetoing State Department personnel just by the handful, a half a dozen, just in the past few days, who they put forward as significant players in this organization?
That's correct. They are doing that. So what we're seeing is the ongoing fight between the State Departments and the Defense Department playing out in this context, which is, I think, a very dangerous development because the plans are sort of fly by night enough, as it were, and it will be very important that the plan is as advanced as it can be, and we're not seeing this bureaucratic infighting continue. We saw it play out in the Congress this week as well when the Appropriations Committees decided rather than give the $2.5 billion in reconstruction assistance to the Pentagon to give it to the State Department. It is the traditional place for that kind of money to go, and in that sense, I agree with it, but it does perhaps create a problem if you put the Office of Reconstruction and Humanitarian Assistance in the Pentagon but mm-hmm. give the money to the State Department.
It's kind of incredible to have this much flux on what now may be a post-war period that's only days away. Who knows? But Bathsheba Crocker, we thank you for the big tour of what's ahead. It's a terrific report you've put together, and we thank you for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Bathsheba Crocker joined us from Washington. She's a resident at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and lead author of Post-War Iraq, Are We Ready? You can continue this conversation on our website. Go to onepointradio.org and click on forums. In a moment, an Oregon writer still struggling to make up her mind about the war. This is On Point. We have all been hearing the arguments for and against the war in Iraq for nearly a year now. Millions have taken to the streets to protest the war, and countless others have lined up behind President Bush. But Portland, Oregon resident Gabrielle Glazer, even now, still can't make up her mind. In this radio diary, Glazer said she agrees with both sides of the debate over the war.
For the first time in my life, I'm in a strange position. I can see almost everyone's point. As I talk with friends, sift through papers, and switch channels, I find myself agreeing with whoever seems to have a cogent argument. I'm shocked to admit this, but the gamut runs from Michael Moore to William Sapphire. At any given moment, I share outrage over fictitious election results, what Dick Cheney's former employer stands to gain in post-war Iraq, shady contracts a French chemical company made with Baghdad, the abandonment of the Kurds. The other day, I called my friend Eric Khoury, a psychiatrist who lives in Napa, California. After a recent peace march, Khoury discussed the war with his young son, Alexander. The boy has been taught to use his words to resolve conflict and was perplexed by the notion that adults were not. Alexander wanted to convey his fears about people getting hurt, so the next day, father and son drew posters. Alexander says, "No war." The experience brought me down to a psychological ground zero, Khoury told me. I felt as if I was making a difference by helping to raise a socially conscious child. That notion made me sympathetic to the demonstrators. Is this really about liberating Iraq? Will the country's oil wells really be the property of the Iraqi people, as President Bush claims? Then there is Rachel Atterbury, a friend whose husband Mike is on a nuclear submarine. Where, she can't say. Her stoicism inspires both guilt and admiration. I'm going to support the people who've put their lives on the line, she told me. I don't want to live in a country where people are paid to protest or not protest, whatever their dictator decides they ought to be doing that day. Terrorism is real, she added. It doesn't just happen in other countries anymore. And so it is that I agree with her, too. We know Saddam is not benign. I'm not convinced about his links to al-Qaeda, but it's possible to imagine Iraqis selling their biological and chemical weapons to any one of the many who hate us. I have my own reminders of that danger. For the past 6 years, I lived in a small town outside New York. 9 of its residents were killed on September 11th. I think about those dark weeks daily, and frequent emails from a grief-stricken friend make it numbingly real, despite a move back to Oregon last summer. During the anthrax scare, my husband inhaled powder enclosed in a letter mailed to a colleague. The New York City Health Department issued him a 2-week supply of Cipro. The letter was later ruled a hoax. A few pills remain in the amber bottle, though, a frightening memento in our medicine cabinet. When I was growing up on a farm in Oregon, danger was far, Vietnam farther. One day, the world arrived in a form I recognized. The image of Kim Phuc, the girl who ran screaming from fire in napalm, seared into my consciousness. It was 1972. She was 9. I was 8. Only the most resolute can overcome the anger ordinarily resulting from such an atrocity. How will children charred by coalition bombs and their humiliated parents not end up loathing us, free Iraq or no? My friend, the September 11th widow, is perhaps too tired to feel rage. In a recent dispatch, she struggled with the dull reality of life without her husband. Her 3 kids need shuttling between school, sports events, and grief counseling. Maybe it's her concern for her children's future that touches most profoundly on my uneasiness. Because from it, who can't draw larger questions? Will they be okay, she wrote. I just want someone to tell me they will be.
Gabrielle Glazer is a columnist for the Oregonian newspaper. She lives in Portland, Oregon. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Support for